A few years ago, my guest James Conaway interviewed the controversial Secretary of the Interior, James Watt, for a Washington Post story. When Conaway walked into Watt's office, he experienced an epiphany. The Pentagon may have the power to destroy, but the Interior Department has real estate, millions of prime acres in the West. That public land captured Conaway's imagination, not only because it has been preserved from private ownership, but also because it's the province of American legend, of cowboys, gold miners, gunslingers, and other loners looking for fortune or freedom. Conaway left his Washington Post job and took off for the public lands of the West to see how those legends compare to today's reality. He's written a book titled The Kingdom in the Country about the inhabitants and the bureaucrats of the land nobody owns. James Conaway has traveled extensively. In 1981, he backpacked within a few hundred miles of the North Pole for a National Geographic story. He grew up in Tennessee, and he's also written for the New York Times Magazine, Harper's, and The Atlantic, and he's written four other books. James Conaway, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
Have you had romantic visions of the Wild West? Did you grow up with romantic visions?
Well, I grew up on the edge of the West, or at least one notion of the West, in Memphis, Tennessee. When I was a teenager, Memphis boasted of having more churches than gas stations, which was not a settling thought for a teenager. I used to dream of escaping to the West, although I didn't really know it, and I never got out there until years later. I lived for a while in California, and I worked in various Western states, but didn't feel that I knew the West the way I wanted to.
Was your image of the West shaped by movies or by something else?
Of course, it was shaped by movies. It was also shaped by my own family that had spent time out there. My father was a wrangler one year just for the heck of it, and his old spurs hung on our wall in Memphis, and just as I hang on my wall today in Washington, and I used to look at them and think that here was a symbol of a man who didn't care much about horses but was interested in escape. And I think that was what really drew me out west.
I'd like to get a sense of the public land that exists now in America. Which states does it cover? And we'll get to the basic rules about it afterwards. Why don't we start with how extensive it is and in which states?
Well, the way it came home to me, which I think would give you a better picture of it, is I went home after I'd done an interview with Watt, and I spread a map of public lands on the floor of my living room. And I realized that in the West, we're talking about the 11 intermountain states from the Rocky Mountains extending westward. I realized that a person could travel from Mexico to Canada and seldom have to leave these lands and never get out of sight of them. That, in fact, was the kingdom of the title of my book, The Kingdom in the Country. And it occurred to me that places in Washington State had a great deal in common with places in New Mexico, although they might not know it, that here was an entity that was governed by its own rules, its own regulations, and had its own history. I suspected that it was a repository for what still endured of the notion of the American West, and I set out to find out if that was in fact the case.
What are some of the basic rules about who can use the public land and how it can be used?
Well, the uses of public lands are varied, and the influence of them is vast. The most obvious users are cattlemen and sheepmen who lease parts of the West to run their animals on. Many of the huge ranches that we hear of in the West are, in fact, a small part of private land where the rancher has his house, and vast acreless tracts where he leases to run the animals. Besides that, there's timbering, there's mining, and then there's a great deal of illegal activity. Among it, the stealing of Indian artifacts, which I got into. There's the growing of marijuana on public lands all over the West. And there are those marginal enterprises like all-terrain vehicles that careen around the desert areas that are strictly legal, but the activity is lawless.
Part of the myth of the West is that it was always a refuge for loners, for drifters, for outlaws. Is that still the case?
Absolutely. It's a refuge for what I suppose you could call individualists. There's a lot of talk in the East about individualism, but there are many Easterners who wouldn't know an individual if he was served to them on a cracker. And I was struck most by the variety and the intensity of private life as it is lived either on public lands or as it is influenced by public lands. There were many stories, but there's a man in Wyoming who still makes his living. I call him a gunfighter. He calls himself a range detective. He's a man who has made his reputation with his gun. He could have stepped out of the 1870s. When I found him in a remote part of Wyoming where sheep rustling is still a viable career choice, he was hired by a rancher to more or less defend 30,000 acres. He has had a unique form of job security. As he told me, one ranch hires me and I run the rustlers off and they go next door and then they hire me. It's a quite incredible story, but he demonstrated how fast he was with his gun, first unloading it, then showing how he draws and shoots from the hip, performing a circular motion, a quite fluid experience, quite fast. Then he reloaded his gun and turned as if to go back into the house that he lives, and suddenly the gun was in his hand. It was literally faster than I could see. I saw something in his eyes, these cornflower blue eyes that I had not ever seen in a person's eyes before.
What?
It was a certain implacable, impersonal force that made the hair stand up quite literally on the back of my neck. Then the gun went off with a tremendous crash and a rock about the size of a 50-cent piece, 15 or 20 feet away, jumped up in the air. He had just nicked the upper corner of it, and he shrugged his shoulders and said, "Shooting high today," and put the gun back in his holster and went in the house.
This is a fellow named Ed Cantrell, who you write about in The Kingdom and the Country. How did you meet up with him? Hadn't you heard a lot of stories about him before you actually found him?
Yes, I read a story about him being tried for murder in Rock Springs, Wyoming, about a decade before. And there was a newspaper story in a newspaper out west at some point where he had been interviewed, and the person who wrote the interview said something about his being a range detective in the area around Casper, Wyoming, but I could not find him. No one knew where he was. I called his lawyer. I called a person that he had worked for in another part of Wyoming who said, "Ed's a good man, but he likes to work alone." Eventually, somebody came up with an old telephone number of a ranch. I called the number many times. No one ever answered. I found myself in Wyoming doing another aspect of the book, and I said, "What the heck? I think I'll just go there and see if I can find him." And in fact, I did. I lucked out, and he was there, and we spent some time together, during which he showed me how to draw and showed me some of the other techniques that he uses in his business.
So is this a guy who just travels around the public lands looking for business?
Well, he travels around the West, as I said, from one ranch to another, and his job is to discourage people from rustling. Whether or not he actually shoots people doesn't seem to matter. It's really his reputation, and the point being that the West in that sense hasn't changed. Gunfighters always live by their reputation. They got more done and encountered more danger because of what they were reputed to be able to do rather than what they actually did. The power of guns is really what we're talking about, the prevalence of guns in the West. Guns were everywhere. Their import was much greater than the collective muzzle velocity, I think. There are fewer people get shot in the West probably nowadays. The number of people who get shot in relation to the number of guns that exist is really quite minuscule. But here was a person who actually made his living, if not using his gun, with the reputation of what his gun could do. And in that sense, nothing has changed in more than a century of the West.
My guest is journalist James Conaway, and we're talking about the subject of his book, The Kingdom in the Country, which is about the miners, the wranglers, the cowboys, the bureaucrats, and the gunfighters who live in the public lands in the West. In your book, you suggest that the classic cowboys were closer to 19th century hippies than they ever were to the kind of John Wayne cowboy image that we have. Can I ask you to describe what you mean by that?
Well, cowboys have traditionally done dangerous, dirty, very difficult work. I didn't realize how difficult it was till I took part in a couple of roundups in the West. Probably the best cowboys today and the ones who are engaged in the most dangerous pastime are those who round up wild horses. This is a relatively small band of cowboys. They travel where the wild horses are, which is in the middle of vast tracts of public lands, usually in Nevada. That's the most common state. There are probably 40 or 50,000 wild horses out on the range. They're not easy to catch. You have to be a good rider, but you also have to be able to work in concert with a helicopter, which is used to corral them. The cowboys that I was talking about in the 19th century were people who were willing to take a bedroll and a change of clothes and get on a horse and ride from Texas to Montana. They didn't expect a lot out of life except freedom and the ability to do what they wanted to do. I think these men are like that today. The curious thing is that they are heavily dependent upon, in this case, American Express. The man that I was with owed American Express $50,000. He was living on credit, waiting to get paid for the federal government for all the horses he had rounded up. He and his partner had also wrecked two helicopters within the last 6 months. As he said, that makes the insurance companies real nervous. I asked the pilot how does one go about surviving a helicopter crash? Your chances are not very good, as you probably know. And he said, well, you just sit there and you wait till things stop flying around and then you jump out. So I pass that along in case you ever need it.
Yeah, I hope not. The 40,000 to 50,000 wild horses that you mentioned, I always figured that they were part of the legacy of the Wild West, but the way you explain it in your book, they're actually more of a legacy of the Depression.
Well, they are a legacy in a way of the Wild West. I mean, the horses came here, they came to the West, but they are envisioned by what I call the wild horse lobby, which is an urban phenomenon. It's not a Western rural phenomenon. They are envisioned as descendants of the mounts of the conquistadors, which is not the case. They are the descendants of nags that were turned out during the Depression because people couldn't afford to feed them. They are not, by and large, they are not beautiful animals. They are usually scarred. They fight a lot among themselves. They're not too healthy. They eat a lot more than a cow does. They're destructive to the range. Some of them should indeed exist, I agree, but not 40,000. Also, I don't think that we as American citizens should pay $20 million a year just to preserve them, to put them in feedlots and feed them hay until they drop dead of old age, which is in fact the case. I think they should be usefully employed in some way, even if that means putting them into dog food. This is something that people don't want to hear, and I've been criticized quite a bit about this as being insensitive to the plight of animals. All I'm saying is that the wild horse is a poor symbol of the wild and untrammeled West, and that the people who are supporting them, I think their sentiments are quite good, just misplaced. I wish they would shift their emphasis to the grizzly bear, which is a creature that really needs them and is really the great symbol of what we're talking about here, a place where man's dominion is not complete and where there's still a chance to encounter something in the wilds that is bigger than we are.
So the way you're describing it, a lot of the people who live out in the West resent the groups that have been established to try to preserve the wild horses.
Well, some of them do. The ranchers, of course, don't like to run cows in competition with the horses. In my opinion, the range is overused, whether it's by horses, wild horses, cows, burros, or sheep. The real point I'm making is that people don't realize the competition that exists for a very limited amount of resources in the West, particularly in the arid parts.
So for food, for instance, the horses are grazing on land that the cattlemen and the sheep herders want for their herds.
Yes, that's right. But all of this land, in fact, belongs to us, to you and me. It's a public resource, and it should be, in my opinion, there should be less grazing of all sorts on it. The other point I was going to make was that people in the West don't have no affection for wild horses by and large. They also, by and large, a lot of them don't have much affection for the grizzly bear. But it's two very different questions, and one of them, in my opinion, is a lot more important symbolically than the other. I'm speaking of the Grizz.
Now, while we're on the subject of horses and cowboys, a lot of the cowboys now are using dirt bikes to herd cattle instead of horses.
Well, that's true. Dirt bike ranching is a real phenomenon in the West. I spent some time with a rancher in New Mexico, a fellow I liked quite a bit, although politically we didn't agree on much, but personally we got along quite well. He has not saddled a horse in 5 years. And I asked him one day why he preferred a dirt bike, and he jerked his thumb at his Honda that was parked in the shade of his house and said, "When that thing's sitting there, it ain't eating," which I thought was one of the most eloquent descriptions that I'd ever heard.
So, I guess there's as much of a fantasy life around motorcycles as there is around horses, too, don't you think?
Absolutely. There's not much difference there. You spend, I guess the big difference is if you have a dirt bike, as a rancher, you spend a lot less time
grooming it.
that's right, and knowing it. And in fact, I think the person is diminished in the process, because the machine is not the same thing. An animal, you know, an animal has a personality. Horses are wonderful animals, and I think they lent a great deal to life in the West as we knew it. There are people who, however, who do spend more time on their machines than people ever spent on horses, and I'm talking about those who ride all-terrain vehicles, which are these three-wheeled jobs that will go almost anywhere in the West. These are urbanites who bring these machines out of places like San Diego and Los Angeles and other cities to romp in the wilderness, and they do more damage per square mile probably than anything other than strip mining. They have a culture of their own. They arrive in by the thousands in certain areas of the desert in Southern California, and at night you cannot believe the matrix of flashing blue, green, red, and yellow lights that cover these sand dunes while thousands of people are competing, driving in all directions. There's no speed limit. There's no direction you can or cannot go in. People are constantly having accidents. There are horrible deaths as a result of this. It also seems to give rise to some sort of strange cultural manifestation whereby people torch public toilets and shoot occasionally Uzis through one another's trailers. It's an inexplicable phenomenon, and one it's terrifying but fascinating.
Well, I want to talk more about your travels through the West, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is James Conaway, a journalist who's the author of The Kingdom in the Country, which is about the West as it is today in the public lands in the West. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Journalist James Conaway is my guest, and he's speaking to us from NPR member station KUOW in Seattle, Washington. We were just talking about all the recreational dirt bikers that come in and tear up the land and all the subsequent battles that ensue around that. You describe in your book constant friction between the ranchers and the recreationalists in the public lands. Do the battles go beyond the dirt bikers who come in?
Oh, yes, I think they do. The dirt bikers often are competing just with the animals and the vegetation in the particular areas they use. Some of these areas are too remote, actually, to run cattle. But the conflicts over public lands are not limited to ranchers and recreationists. They go all the way up to people who strip mine coal in Montana, people who do seismic shooting to discover oil and gas deposits in various national forests. It's really I think it's in the end the question of who owns these lands and how they should be used. And it goes back in history as far as the white man has gone in the history of the West. Some people view the West as a national treasure that should in some ways be preserved. I'm not saying that you should have no development, should have no grazing. That would be foolish. But I think that the West, considering what has happened to the rest of the United States, that it has not had some public land laws to preserve it from development, shows that what we have in the West should be preserved as a national treasure. There are other people historically who have viewed the West as a place to plunder, whether they are miners or ranchers or whatever. And that those two basic positions are the ones that have been at war ever since we've had a West as we know it. They are at war today. You can say there's nothing new about it, but in fact the process has been greatly accelerated by numbers of people who live in the country, by the power of machines, and by the demands for resources and the money it produces. So although it's an old argument and an old battle, it has a certain heightened poignancy now, in my opinion.
Now, I want to ask you briefly about another unusual use that some of the public lands are being put to, and that is the growing of marijuana as a cash crop for the people who plant it. And there are incredible efforts to destroy these marijuana crops. Now, you describe the marijuana crops as being environmentally bad. Would you explain that?
Well, let me back up just a little bit. The marijuana question is much more complicated than people think. Marijuana is grown in great quantities on public lands, often by people who buy land that's adjacent to public lands and move over and grow on the public land so that theoretically they can't be caught. There are parts of the United States, one of which I visited and wrote about in the Kingdom in the Country, which is in Humboldt County in California, where the entire culture is permeated by marijuana. It affects everything from real estate values to what kids buy at the candy store because the kids make money preparing the marijuana for sale. The elected officials, because they are elected, will not arrest anyone for growing marijuana. Consequently, you have the feds who have to come in or feel they have to come in helicopters to try to destroy the source of all revenues in this particular community. It's a fascinating idea. It's the same as visiting a community that would be dependent upon coal or oil or newspapers or whatever. The problem with it is, and I must add that I was in some ways had some respect for the entrepreneurs who would go out and grow this marijuana and then sell it like any other product, but I was dismayed by what they often do to the environment. Marijuana growing today is not it's not as simple as you might imagine. You don't go out and just push a seed into the ground and go and harvest it. They have huge plastic tanks that hold water and fertilizer. They have miles of plastic pipe that bleeds the water and the fertilizer into the plants. They have tons of pesticides that they use to kill wood rats and deer that feed on the marijuana. These animals are killed, and then they're picked up by the raptors and the other things in the food chain, and these pesticides and poisons work themselves all the way down into the trout, into the salmon. So in fact, it's a pervasive thing. Also, a lot of the growers tend to dump their trash because they live in remote areas into the watershed. That also is not good. The thing that dismayed me most, I think, was the fact that children are often used to prepare marijuana and in some cases in a sincere manner. There was one marijuana grower I spent time with saw himself as a small farmer. He did not make a moral distinction between growing marijuana and growing grapes. His kids had their own bank accounts. His kids helped prepare, or what they call manicure marijuana, during the season, and he felt that it was a legitimate way to live. That was his view. The other manifestations of marijuana growing that I saw was that people would, in this town, would rent motel rooms, take their entire crop of marijuana into the motel rooms in plastic bags, spread it around on the floor, turn up the heater and leave for 2 days until it dried out, and then come back and prepare it and sell it. That tells you how pervasive it is in the culture. If that sort of thing can happen and the sheriff's office is 200 yards away and they don't do anything about it, that to me was a fascinating development.
We only have a couple of minutes left. I'm a little interested in how this trip affected you. After 6 months of being out west and traveling around, living a very itinerant life, you went back home to Washington, D.C. to continue your life in the city. Was it difficult to pick up where you left off in the city?
Yes, it was difficult. Fortunately, I had the book to write, which I did with a great amount of concentration. But the West showed me something that I suspected existed in myself, that was a need to get out of of the city and to realize that the West still harbors chances for Americans as it always had. I have to say that writing the book changed my life. The American West changed my life.
How did it change your life?
Well, it made me aware of that there were possibilities beyond what I was doing, that I should look to myself for my own resources and that I should do the things I want to do rather than what other people tell me to do professionally, which is what, in fact, I've been doing since then.
It's funny because what you just said is a kind of restatement of what the whole ethic of the West is, a place to do what you want to do and to not have to be told what to do.
Well, I think that's always been important to Americans. I think it still is. You know, the Census Bureau said there was no frontier in 1890. They were unable to find a difference between civilized and uncivilized areas, but I can tell you that there is a frontier still out there.
Did you ever feel like you were in a movie when you were out working with the cowboys?
Well, I didn't, because the country itself is so overpowering that any sort of, I think any medium is going to have a hard time capturing it. I depended upon the written word, which I think is the old-timey one, but in some ways the most appropriate.
James Conaway, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
James Conaway's book, The Kingdom in the Country, is published by Houghton Mifflin. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.